sensual.
Que nos jours sont plus légers.
From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Sarah Dennis with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, May 2nd. A prescribed burn at Miyaka River State Park led to a wildfire that burned over 700 acres, sparking concerns about conducting burns during drought conditions. While prescribed burns are important for ecosystem management, experts typically avoid them in dry conditions. Despite criticism, state agencies said the burn followed regulations, but did not explain why it occurred during a drought. Controlled burns help maintain habitats for wildlife. Sarasota faces more than $17 million in remaining hurricane damage repairs from the 2024 storms, primarily affecting waterfront parks and piers. While FEMA is expected to reimburse 75% to 85% of costs, delays in past payments and a depleted reserve fund complicate short-term funding. Major restoration projects, including repairs at Bayfront Park, Bird Cave Park, and several piers, are projected to take until late 2026 or 2027. The city will begin budgeting discussion in late July, with this year's hurricane season posing a potential further setback. Former Florida Congressman Mike Waltz resigned as National Security Advisor after just 102 days following a scandal involving a leaked chat about bombing Houthi rebels in Yemen. Waltz invited the Atlantic editor Jeffrey Goldberg to the discussion, and Goldberg later published details, leading to criticism over mishandled classified information. Waltz took responsibility but also criticized Goldberg while President Trump offered public support. A longtime Trump ally and former representative of Florida's 6th District, Waltz has a military background. In a social media post yesterday, Trump announced he appointed Waltz as ambassador to the United Nations. This has been Sarah Dennis with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, May 2nd.
Program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR. LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression, community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Lorini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Although the stated purpose of the actions of this administration's first 100 days was to root out and eliminate waste and fraud in federal government, it seems a more accurate description of the work is to eliminate accountability and kindness in the federal government. Regulatory boards cut by the federal government include the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Equal Opportunity Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Essentially, among the thousands of federal employees that have been fired since Inauguration Day, many of them were tasked with guarding the rights of the American people by policing big business. and there are some interesting choices of the targets for this deregulation. For instance, the moves that have led the SEC to pull back on its attempt to police the cryptocurrency boom. Guess who's making a ton of money, at least on paper, with a crypto-ish meme coin, as well as his family getting involved in the crypto markets, albeit so far in an unclear way. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Tessa Petit, Executive Director of the Florida Immigration Coalition and its 83 members, who will discuss the other seeming motivation of this administration, eliminating any hint of kindness in federal policy. But first, hear this latest example of the elimination of accountability in the name of cost-cutting. I'm sure the $3 million saved by defunding the Social Security Advisory Board is far more significant than the knowledge that group contributes to policy that affects all Americans. The White House wants to defund a bipartisan board that advises the President and Congress on Social Security policy. Two sources familiar with the matter told Reuters, as the Trump administration moves to cut costs and eliminate independent voices in government. The White House's Office of Management and Budget has notified staff of the Social Security Advisory Board that it plans to cut the board's annual budget from around $3 million to zero, according to the sources who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss non-public budgetary details. Congress established it in the 1990s as an independent federal agency to provide objective analysis on how to improve Social Security, the popular program that annually pays out about $1.4 trillion in benefits to 73 million Americans. While the board does not have decision-making power, its research has helped shape how the SSA runs itself and facilitated legislation. It has also played a role in important policy debates, including a 2005 effort under then-President George W. Bush to privatize the agency that ultimately failed. The board's research was a key building block in the 2018 law that reduced the compliance burden for select categories of people appointed to receive benefits on behalf of those who cannot manage their own payments, while tightening checks for others. While technically a separate agency, the advisory board's funding is a line item in the SSA's budget each year. This month, OMB gave SSA its proposed budget for the next fiscal year from October 1st, with funding for the board set at zero, the two sources said. President Donald Trump and his Republican allies have been trying to downsize government while removing or restricting voices that can serve as a check on his agenda. His targets have included the 17 inspectors general fired in January, whose job was to root out waste and fraud. Bob Jonadep, the board's chairman, told Reuters he has yet to be formally notified of the funding decision. Its strength is its bipartisanship. It's one of the few places you can go in government and get something that a bunch of people from different parties can reach consensus on, Jonadep, one of the two Democrats on the four-person board, said. The fact that it would be eliminated to me is symbolic of a sort of the larger trends in Washington. Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency has targeted the Social Security Administration for significant cuts, triggering complaints from union officials, Democratic lawmakers, advocacy groups about longer wait times for phone service and understaffed field offices. The agency has announced plans to eliminate 7,000 jobs, roughly 12% of its workforce. The Social Security Advisory Board was created to help the President and Congress strengthen the program, but now Trump is defunding it, Senator Elizabeth Warren said in a statement to Reuters. Hurricane season is upon us, but according to the current administration, advance warnings are too expensive for taxpayers. Weather and climate research are among the programs seeing big cuts by the Trump administration. Hundreds of employees at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who work at offices and research centers, have been fired. The administration also wants to cut hundreds of millions of dollars in funding for everything from weather satellites to climate research. Andy Hazleton is one of the NOAA employees who lost his job. In February, probationary employees, people who were recently hired or promoted, were fired and then quickly rehired and put on administrative leave following a federal court order. But before the Supreme Court ruling this month, the employees, including Hazleton, were fired again. Hazleton, a physical scientist with NOAA in Miami, loved his job. He says, "Because I'm passionate about the work we do, I've been part of the success that's happened over the last 5 to 10 years in terms of protecting lives and property." Until his job was terminated, Hazleton worked to help understand, track, and forecast hurricanes at NOAA's Environmental Modeling Center. The model he worked on, the Hurricane Analysis and Forecast System, HAFS, contributed to a marked improvement in forecasting. Hundreds of demonstrators protested cuts by the Trump administration outside the headquarters of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration on March 23rd. In Silver Springs, Maryland, the administration fired about 800 probationary staff at NOAA, one of the world's premier centers for climate science. A federal court then ordered the employees to be rehired. Not long after, they were put on administrative leave. HAFS, along with other models developed by NOAA scientists, has greatly improved the ability to forecast hurricanes' track and intensity. Human-driven climate change makes hurricanes more intense. That means people are experiencing more severe storm surge, rain, and wind. Research shows that dangerous storms are getting more common. The deputy director of the National Hurricane Center, Jamie Rome, says that because of the model, scientists now can do something impossible just a decade ago: forecast when a storm may rapidly intensify into a major hurricane, saving lives by giving residents more time to evacuate. There have been several cases where forecasters have aggressively forecast and communicated that rapid intensification was not just a possibility, but in all likelihood was going to occur, Rome said. Last year, the HAFS model Hazleton worked on helped meteorologists accurately forecast the rapid intensification of both hurricanes Helene and Milton. He's one of some 20 people fired from the Environmental Modeling Center and Geophysical Fluid Dynamic Lab, another important NOAA research facility. All the cuts, Hazleton said, may slow or end the progress that's been made in developing weather and climate models. Certainly, as the level of investment goes down, you will lose these improvements, he says. We are already in a situation where we need more investment. While most job terminations were ordered in the name of downsizing and government efficiency, other recent cuts and recommendations appear to be ideological. President Trump's Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick recently announced the withdrawal of $4 million in grants to Princeton University's climate research, saying it promoted exaggerated and implausible climate threats and narratives that don't align with the priorities of this administration. You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. If you think the Justice Department should be policing violations of laws regarding food and drink, think again. The Justice Department unit that handles criminal and civil enforcement of U.S. food and drug safety laws is being disbanded as part of an ongoing cost-cutting campaign by President Donald Trump's administration, according to three people familiar with the matter. About 215 people work for the Consumer Protection Branch, part of the Justice Department's Civil Division, including attorneys, support staff, and law enforcement agents. It was listed as possible target for cuts in a March memo by Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche and was first reported by Reuters. A Justice Department spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Although it's located in the Civil Division, the Consumer Protection Branch is an unusual office because its work involves a hybrid of criminal prosecutions and civil enforcement. It handles criminal cases to enforce the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, a federal law that makes it a crime to sell or distribute adulterated or misbranded food or drugs. It also enforces statutes for the Federal Trade Commission and the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Three sources speaking on condition of anonymity confirmed the plans for disbanding the Consumer Protection Branch. Two of the sources said that the more than 100 attorneys who work for the unit were notified last week about the plans to break it up. Attorneys from the unit who handled criminal cases will be relocated to the department's criminal division, while the rest of the unit's employees will remain in the civil division, the three sources said. Some who do primarily legal work for the Food and Drug Administration will be transferred to the Justice Department's Federal Programs Branch, they said. It remains unclear where others will be placed, according to two of the sources. The target date to complete the changes is by the end of the current fiscal year, which is September 30th, one of the sources said. The plan to disband the branch were reported earlier by the American Prospect news outlet. The Consumer Protection Branch has been at the heart of some high-profile cases. Prosecutors from the branch also brought the criminal case against former executives of a peanut corporation for crimes that led to the 2009 outbreak involving more than 700 cases of salmonella poisoning. It just got easier for the federal government to crack down on investigative reporting. The U.S. Justice Department under President Donald Trump made it easier for prosecutors investigating leaks to the news media to subpoena records and testimony from journalists, according to a memo seen by Reuters last week that reversed a Biden-era policy. New regulations detailed in the memo will allow prosecutors in criminal investigations to use subpoenas, court orders, and search warrants to compel production of information and testimony by and regulating to members of the news media, the memo said. Safeguarding classified privilege and other sensitive information is essential to effective governance and law enforcement, Attorney General Pam Bondi wrote in the memo. A source familiar with the matter said the policy took effect immediately. The Justice Department and the White House did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The directive reverses a policy the department implemented during Democratic President Joe Biden's administration that barred prosecutors from seizing reporters' phones and email records in most circumstances. The Biden administration's policy followed criticism of the Justice Department for secretly subpoenaing records on reporters and congressional staff members as prosecutors pursued leaks of national security information during Trump's first term from 2017 to 2021. The department's former policy, implemented under Attorney General Merrick Garland, barred the Justice Department from compelling records from reporters unless the journalist was a suspect in a criminal investigation unrelated to news gathering or they had obtained information through criminal methods. Bondi said the Justice Department will employ procedural protections before demanding information from reporters, including giving advance notice to the journalists and requiring leadership approval in some situations, according to the memo. She said subpoenas and search warrants related to journalists would be narrowly targeted, and she would consider whether the information could be obtained another way. These procedural protections recognize that investigative techniques related to news gathering are an extraordinary measure to be deployed as a last resort when essential to a successful investigation or prosecution, Bondi wrote in the memo. The Attorney General must also approve efforts to question or arrest members of the news media, the memo said. The new policy was first reported by ABC. The Trump administration has taken an assertive approach in dealing with the news media, including restricting the Associated Press's access to the White House over its decision to refer to the Gulf of Mexico and taking control of the White House pool, a function previously performed by the White House Correspondents Association. some of the most consequential reporting in U.S. history, from Watergate to wireless wiretapping after 9/11, was and continues to be made possible because reporters have been able to protect the identities of confidential sources and uncover and report stories that matter to people across the political spectrum, said Bruce Brown, president of the Reporters Committee, an advocacy group for journalists, in a statement. Strong protections for journalists serve the American public by safeguarding the free flow of information. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche said last month that the department would investigate a leak of what he called classified intelligence information about a Venezuelan gang. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth warned of possible criminal prosecutions of former senior advisors who were fired following leak probes. They may be loath to admit it, but more and more companies are calling foul on the tariffs. General Motors, Kraft Heinz, and Electrolux on April 29th joined a diverse list of companies that have pulled forecasts for 2025 or slashed outlooks as President Donald Trump's trade war sends a chill through the corporate world. GM also pushed its investor call to May 1st, pending possible changes to tariff policy, while delivery giant UPS said it would cut 20,000 jobs to lower costs in an uncertain economy and in anticipation of weak volumes from its largest customer, Amazon. The barrage of negative news is more evidence that chaotic trade policy is taking a major toll on companies, forcing many to cut spending, upending supply chains, and making it hard to plan beyond the immediate term. Consumers are also spending less as Trump's imposition of sweeping tariffs, followed by the suspension or rollback of some duties, creates uncertainty, raising fears of sharp economic downturn in the United States and beyond. We believe the future impact of tariffs could be significant, GM Chief Financial Officer Paul Jacobson told a media call after the U.S. carmaker pulled its forecast for the year. We're telling folks not to rely on the prior guidance, and we'll update when we have more information around tariffs. World stocks and the dollar edged up on April 29th, and after Washington said it planned to reduce the impact of some auto tariffs, but markets are far from recovering the heavy losses suffered after the levies were outlined on April 2nd. About 40 companies worldwide have revised their forward guidance in the first 2 weeks of the first quarter season, a Reuters analysis shows. GM and Volvo Cars abandoned their outlooks on April 29th, joining U.S. airline Delta, computer gadget maker Logitech, and drinks giant Diageo. Ketchup maker Kraft Heinz, meanwhile, trimmed its annual forecast. Hotel operator Hilton cut its 2025 revenue outlook, and Porsche and Electrolux cut their full-year outlooks. No question, the uncertainty surrounding exactly what could happen with demand is about as high as we've ever seen, Carson Group's chief market strategist Ryan Dietrich said, predicting that more companies would suspend or withdraw guidance. German sports car maker Porsche AG said it suffered a hit of at least $111 million across April and May as a result of U.S. import tariffs. There's so much volatility out there. There's so much information coming in, some of which is reliable, some of which is not. CFO Jochen Breckner said, warning that Porsche would have to pass on tariff costs to customers via price increases, at least in part. The tariffs are expected to raise U.S. car prices by thousands of dollars, reducing demand and piling pressure on an automobile industry already struggling with a slow transition to electric vehicles. Porsche has no U.S. production, and Volvo Cars shipped most of the cars it sells in the United States from Europe, meaning they are particularly exposed to the 25% charge on car imports and would gain little from a mooted softening of the duties. Estimates by at least 10 firms in the U.S. and Europe of the likely costs associated with the tariffs include steps to mitigate the impact, amount to a cumulative $3 billion for this year. Others have provided a likely range underlying the uncertain impact. Also on April 29th, Hilton became the first U.S.-based hotel operator to temper its outlook as consumers cut spending on travel. It is clearest, it is the clearest warning yet from a major bank as to how the ripple effects of Trump's tariffs could hurt lenders. HSBC said fallout from the global trade war could hit loan demand and credit quality. And joining a chorus of household names from Nestle to Unilever to Chipotle, Electrolux blamed weaker consumer sentiment for a lowered North American market outlook after reporting a first quarter profit miss. History tells us that prolonged uncertainty will feed into consumers' purchasing decisions, Danish brewer Carlsberg CEO Jacob Arif Andersen told Reuters. Trump has inadvertently made Canada great again. Mark Carney won the Canadian election to continue his term as Prime Minister. Canada's election authority reported closing his victory after President Trump's aggressive rhetoric and tariffs lifted the ruling Liberal Party to a remarkable political comeback. Carney's win was a repudiation of Trump's threats to annex Canada and make it the 51st state. That rhetoric, along with punishing tariffs on Canadian goods, has sparked an unprecedented wave of nationalism and overturned years of stability between the two neighbors. As I have been warning for months, America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country, Carney said. But these are not idle threats. President Trump is threatening to break us so that America can own us. That will never happen. Our old relationship with the United States, a relationship based on steadily increasing integration, is over, Carney said in a victory speech in Ottawa. The system of open global trade anchored by the United States, a system that Canada has relied on since the Second World War, a system that, while not perfect, has helped deliver prosperity for the country for decades, is over. These are tragedies, but it's also our new reality. Carney, a central banker with a little formal government experience, called a snap election late last month as the Liberal Party surged in polls to close a more than 20% deficit since the beginning of 2025. With almost all votes counted on April 29th, results from the Elections Canada showed the Liberals had won 168 electoral districts, followed by the Conservatives with 144. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who just 3 months ago had looked certain to sweep the polls, lost his seat in the Ontario district of Carleton to Liberal Bruce Fanjoy. The Liberals have been in power for more than 9 years, where 20 percentage points behind surveys in January before the unpopular Justin Trudeau announced he was quitting as prime minister, and Trump started threatening tariffs and annexation. It was the anybody but conservative factor. It was the Trump tariff factor, and then it was the Trudeau departure, which enabled a lot of left of center voters and traditional liberal voters to come back to the party, said Saatchi Kirl, president of the Angus Reid Institute polling firm. Despite the gains, the Liberals will not gain the outright majority that Carney had sought to help him negotiate with Trump on tariffs threatening Canada's economy. They needed 172 of the House of Commons, 343 seats, to be able to rule without the support of a smaller party. Carney said in coming months, the coming months will be challenging and require sacrifices. Poilievre conceded defeat and said his party would continue to hold the government to account. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Coming up next is my conversation with Tessa Petit, Executive Director of the Florida Immigration Council.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome back Tessa Petit, Executive Director of the Florida Immigration Coalition. And it's 83 members working to build a Florida where everyone can live, labor, and love without fear. Thanks for making time for us today, Tessa. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, Lou. And thank you for having me.
You know, last time we spoke, which was basically the end of last year, shortly after Election Day, it was still unclear how the current administration was going to carry out the promised mass deportations of at least a million people per year who are in the country legally. But from what we've seen so far, the rule of law and due process are being treated as only suggestions. How is FLIC responding to these actions?
There's different, it's happening at different levels, right? And with attacks on different groups. So at the community level, we're making sure that our community members know their constitutional rights, not just, and I think at some point there was this rumor that the Know Your Rights was actually misinforming undocumented immigrants and that it was obstruction of justice. Well, I think now people are realizing that not only Know Your Rights are truly every single human being's constitutional right on this U.S. territory, but that now what people were taking for granted and thinking that only undocumented immigrants needed to know, I hope that now even U.S. citizens realize that it is in their best interest to be reminded of their constitutional rights, because now it's not a question of what your real immigration status is. It's more a question of whether or not you look like someone who potentially could be an immigrant in this country. So we are teaching people their constitutional rights to protect them against those attacks. We're also sharing information to family members on how to prepare for a potential deportation, but also with a fine a family member if somebody gets detained, what to do next, where do you locate them, what's the information that you need. And to undocumented immigrants, and even to those who are legal permanent residents, we're saying share your information with someone, right? Somebody needs to know your A number so that somebody can try to locate you if you ever get picked up. But then the other part of the work that we find ourselves having to do is even work closely with elected officials who are being threatened and coerced into making decisions that they don't want to make, being threatened of losing their positions just because we have a current Florida administration who wants them to sign those agreements with ICE that will only create more fear in the community and that they're not required to go into, but then they're being threatened to be removed from their positions, and so they're signing this. So we'll also find ourselves not only having to work with the communities, but also having to work with our elected officials to tell them we're here to stand up with you to protect our immigrant communities.
Yeah, are some of these elected officials, say sheriffs that aren't real interested in colluding with ICE to round people up?
Yes. Yeah, so based on Florida law, all counties are required to have a 287G, but then municipalities, cities, and certainly not universities, they're not required to have 287Gs. And so when some of them are trying not to, and we saw that with the city of Fort Myers, they receive a letter from the attorney general threatening them to either do it or lose their jobs. And so we want to let, and with that, all it takes is a threat to one for all of them, I guess, to hesitate and fold. And that's what we're seeing. That's why there's right now a lot of potential 287Gs from a lot of cities pending with ICE.
Originally, the targets of these deportation roundups were supposed to be only criminals. you know, but among the 800 immigrants caught in the first days of this latest operation tidal wave that I guess, used a bunch of, Florida law enforcement folks, were they gang members or, as the administration says, murderers and rapists?
See, I very much doubt that that's what they were. I mean, we've seen it in, we've seen a call from a House representative from Tampa saying that, you know, there's this mother who has a child that she cares for. She's the only caregiver for her child. We've seen a couple of calls for assistance throughout the state, and we know that the 800 of them were definitely not criminals. If there were really 800 folks who were picked up, they were, and in their report, they did say that about 300 of them had a final order of deportation. First of all, we know that the majority of immigrants who have a final order of deportation are not criminals. Barely 3 or 4% of them may have criminal records. And we know that immigrants who are walking in the streets of Florida are also not all of them or the majority of them criminals. So that this rhetoric, this sort, this narrative that they're only picking up criminals and off of our streets and making our streets safe is a lie. And I believe that every Floridian who's been here long enough and who has at least a coworker, a friend, a neighbor, every single Floridian knows at least one immigrant or has a close relationship with at least one immigrant. I'm pretty sure they all know that these are lies.
It doesn't seem like they've thought it through very well. Originally the targets of these, what are they doing with the immigrants awaiting deportation? I mean, I understand the Chrome Detention Center in, Miami is like, three times, past its limit. Used to be, it's like 1,700 people in a tent city there.
So, Chrome originally had a capacity of 600. Last we heard was about 1,600 to 1,700. We also heard that they are building a plexiglass tent city in the yard. We've also received reports of folks being chained in buses, spending the night in buses for days because there's no room inside Chrome. This is inhumane. We know that they are also holding folks at the Broward Transition Center. We also know that with all of these 287Gs and the racial profiling that is happening, I think is it Orange County that says that they've seen about 20 people a day being brought into county jail for a 48-hour hold until ICE decides whether or not they're going to be picked up for deportation. This is costing resources, a lot of money to detain these folks. One, two, these are people who, for some reason, met with law enforcement and could not immediately prove their immigration status, and so they are being picked up. So it's our jails. It's the reason why we have law enforcement. It's the way that people are treated. There's no room to put all of these people, certainly not in the state of Florida. We also understand that there are now flights that are being they're now figuring flights to and ways to bring people to Guantanamo because they're running out of space in Florida. We want people to know these are not criminals. These are people who are living, working, taking care of their families, taking care of our families, of your families. And these are people who, given the time and the right immigration lawyer, could most likely make their case. With the right immigration structure also in this country, they could probably make their case and get a path to citizenship. So what is happening is really inhumane.
Yeah, you know, and thinking too of you know, another angle of the deportations. I mean, are they starting to have an effect on the stock of you know, necessary workers in agriculture, and I can think of you know, construction. You know, if not people who I guess, you know, have unsettled immigration status, but everybody else who just is afraid they're going to get rounded up, whether they have immigration, you know, whether they're on the way to citizenship or not, right? Is that?
Yeah, I think because of the efforts that the current administration has done to even remove status for people who have a temporary status, and these are people who came into this country invited. And because of all the confusion and chaos that has been created, we're definitely going to see so much impact on our communities. The very first one being the emotional impact, because people are afraid. I think America has taken its freedom for granted for so long. For many of us who come from countries with very unstable politics and a very unstable history, we're familiar with what it feels like to live in fear and to live day by day, not knowing what tomorrow has in store for us. And that's where we are now. And that's where immigrant communities are now. Sure. So there's the mental, there's the emotional distress, right? The asking ourselves, what's next? When is my turn going to be, and how deep down in the shadows can I hide not to get picked up? And then there's the economic impact, because one, employers don't know who can actually work anymore and who doesn't, because they don't know which work permit is still valid and which is not because of all this chaos. And we have people are losing their jobs, so, you know, they can't make their rent. People are afraid to go to work. So, of course, there's that too, and they can't pay the rent. They can't feed their kids. You have children who are afraid to go to school, which is a basic right for every child. And then, you know, when I try to tell people, if you're not an immigrant, think about it that way. If you have a child who's in school, how is your child going to feel when day after day they keep seeing their friends disappearing in their classroom? How are they feeling? What are you telling them? So there's a lot of weight on our communities, and then there's the economy of the state. Now, of course, we hear the governor say that, you know, we will use child labor to replace the immigrant labor shortage. But come on, Floridians. We already know who these kids are going to be. These are going to be the children of our minority communities. Is it that we don't care that now children are going to be used to cover a labor shortage in our state, because we think that eventually it's not going to be our kids, it's going to be the children of Black people and the children of immigrants who are going to have to pick up those jobs? There's so much that's coming out of this, including the dehumanization of Americans and America, that I think we need to look at so many aspects of the impact of what is happening now is having on the America that so many fights have happened to get it to where it is now, right? And now to see all that being destroyed.
You know, and what I see is you know, the you know, response and defense of this policy, at least from the beginning, was always, you know, we aren't against immigration. We're only against illegal immigration, people that try to come here, you know, without going through the proper steps. But we're finding out that, you know, that's not really the case. I mean, people with settled immigration status. I mean, it's people with green cards, people with work visas, like you already mentioned. you know, they're being rounded up and deported anyway. And also, too, of course, this big charge that all these immigrants are just, you know, violent, crazy criminals that are members of violent gangs and everything, when all the statistics for years has shown that immigrants to this country are in the lowest, have the lowest rate of being criminals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is what are they saying? And it's all coming to pass, you know.
Yes, and it is so. It's frightening to see how quickly we have how quickly we took everything in, right? America's taking everything in and believing this, and it's now, of course, there's the othering, right? Because it's every immigrant is a criminal except immigrants who's my friend. That's not how it works, because once the narrative is normalized, it makes a deeper change in the way our society starts functioning, because then it makes it acceptable that structures are built against that set of people. And so I hope that there will be, I hope that at some point there will be definitely a wake-up call that will help folks realize that these are all lies. This is not the promise that we were made. The promise that we were made was, the promise that he made to America was that he would, remove undocumented immigrants, that he would remove criminals, which the law has always been established that if you commit a felony in this country, you know, you're subject to deportation. But that was not, he didn't say he was going to attack innocent people. He didn't say he was going to remove immigration status from people. And he didn't say that he was going to separate families at the rate that he's separating them now.
Yeah, I just want to interrupt for a second and remind people just tuning in. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Tessa Petit, who is the executive director of the Florida Immigration Coalition. Yeah, that is, you know, an important part, and of course our very own governor, you know, is so on board with this, you know, policy that they pushed through that law about making it, you know, illegal under Florida law for anybody who is quote unquote entered this country illegally from entering Florida, that it would become an actual crime. And it seems like the only person that they picked up, you know, Juan Carlos Lopez Gomez, was a citizen. This is just an example of I guess why, you know, all of us need to be concerned. I mean, does that mean, you know, if you have a tan and dark hair, you know, you better have your papers on hand?
Yes, that's what it means. But I do want to. That's what it means. So the recommendation really is to better be safe than sorry. Make sure you have your ID with you. You're ready to identify yourself regardless of your actual status in this country, number one. Number two, the true concern that they show. So one is that the gentleman was not the only one. Juan Carlos was not the only one that was picked up by the Florida Highway Patrol, and what we're seeing as a trend is that our local government is following this trend that we're also seeing at the federal government, which is to not honor a court order, temporary restraining order, we're seeing this sudden tendency to disregard the court. And so my concern is that, so one, you know, where are we going if this becomes normal? Because the court, there's a reason why there are three branches of government, right, for a check and balance.
Sure.
But my other thing is, once you do that, then will there be due process anymore for our folks, for our community members? How will they ever be protected anymore?
Yeah, you know, you bring up a very important point, and of course that brings to mind, you know, the huge example of unlawful overreach in the case of the more than 200 Venezuelans in Kilmer Abrego Garcia who've been sent to El Salvador, and the Supreme Court ordered them, you know, let's get the language right, to facilitate their return. But the Supreme Court totally said they're entitled, all those guys entitled to due process, which it seems like the administration, is kind of ignoring. I mean, if this stains, you know, don't people need to realize that we're, you know, all simply can be just labeled a danger to the U.S. without proof of due process and sent to El Salvador? I mean, any one of us. I mean, but, right? I mean, this is what's going on.
Now, I do want to say that, I mean, President Trump did say it, you know, he did say, why not? Why not deport U.S. citizens to El Salvador?
Good.
And, you know, it was clear. So, and then the other thing is, you know, when you get a U.S. citizen, like you get a child, already three children have been deported. You get a child who's getting cancer treatment, who's being deported and saying, well, it was an error. How many U.S. lives are going to be dismissed as errors? And it just takes one life to be dismissed as an error for it to become okay and for anarchy to step in. And that's what I want people to also understand is that, you know, it's not if your turn is next, it's when is your turn next, because you have to check a series of boxes. And I want people to understand that it's a question of color, it's a question of class, it's a question of whitening, of the of America, but not just whitening of America in case of in the sense of skin color. It's also whitening America in the sense of class. And I would love America to realize, you know, at some point, all of these things that are happening will take away everybody's freedoms, and it's not going to matter if you're still here. You're not going to be free while being here, and you will no longer have access to benefits that you're so familiar with. For example, when they're getting rid of Medicaid, the majority of people who are on Medicaid are white Americans, right? So when they're getting rid of Medicaid and you're not saying anything because it's like, well, you know, it's because it's immigrants have been taking advantage of it. It's not true. We don't get food stamps. We don't get the Medicaid the way they're talking about it. And you're letting them take it away thinking, oh, when they're taking it away, they're going to make sure that they don't take it away from me. That's not how it's going to work. And so it's letting America know everything that is being destroyed right now under the premise that it is to take it away from immigrants. It's actually taking it away from everybody. And we're digging out, you know, folks are digging their own graves by letting things happen the way they're happening, including their right to be, as U.S. citizens, their right to be in this country.
Okay. Well, you know, on that note, you know, I want to thank you, Tessa Petit, for making time for me today. And, you know, once again, you know, everybody needs to understand, as in making the very excellent point, what everybody needs to understand, you know, what they do to immigrants is what they're doing to all of us, you know. Do you have anything else, you know, I mean, how can people learn more about this and what Flick is up to?
Definitely. To learn more about what we're doing, anybody can go on our website, www.flick.org. You go to our events page. You can see all of the trainings that we're offering. You can sign up as a volunteer or a Flickster or sign up for our newsletter. And you will learn about everything that we're doing in the community, updates on what's happening, updates on federal laws. Please join us. Join Flick. We need folks to help us protect our communities. And also, I'd be remiss not to ask folks to donate because there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and we're also trying to build some mutual aid funds to help our immigrant communities who are in distress now. So just visit our website and follow us on our social media. We're on Instagram, on Facebook. It's Florida Immigrant Coalition.
Thank you again, Tessa. You have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Saying the Florida Department of Environmental Protection did not adequately consider the sensitive nature of the area, an administrative law judge this week said the state should reject a permit to drill for oil near the Apalachicola River. Judge Lawrence P. Stevenson issued a 53-page recommendation order that sided with the environmental group Apalachicola Riverkeeper in a closely watched race. Apalachicola Riverkeeper filed a challenge last year after the Department of Environmental Protection issued a draft permit for Louisiana-based Clearwater Land and Minerals, Florida, to drill an exploratory well in an unincorporated part of Calhoun County, which is between Tallahassee and Panama City. Stevenson wrote that the proposed site was within a 100-year floodplain of the Apalachicola River, is within a mile of two ponds that are hydrologically connected to the river and is surrounded by swampland. He said the DEP and Clearwater took an exceedingly narrow view of the scope of the project for purposes of environmental review, limiting it to the immediate location of the drilling pad on the site. A spill would have catastrophic consequences due to the proximity of the well to nearby streams, wetlands, and ponds, Stevenson wrote. The case has drawn attention, at least in part, because the state and federal governments have long taken steps to try to protect the river and Apalachicola Bay. They are part of the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River system, which starts in northern Georgia, crosses into Alabama, and ends in the Apalachicola Bay in Franklin County. During this year's legislative session, the Florida House and Senate have moved forward with a proposal aimed at preventing oil drilling near the river and bay. The legislative chambers have not reached agreement on the final version of the bill, HB 1143. Under administrative law, Stevenson's recommended order must go back to the Department of Environmental Protection for a final order. The department in 2019 approved a permit for another company on the same site, but that company, Cholo Petroleum, did not end up drilling, Stevenson wrote. In a document filed in February in the case, the department pointed to safeguards such as berms at the site that it said would prevent the release of pollutants. From a broader perspective, the lands involved, i.e. the area of the well pad and the parcel described in the application, are within the Apalachicola River Basin, the department document said. However, given the location and redundant systems for retaining potential discharges of pollutants at the well pad, the lands involved have no special characteristics that might make them susceptible to pollution. Stevenson, however, took issue with such arguments. For example, he cited a rule about permitting in sensitive areas. It is also noted that DEP abdicated any duty it had to perform an independent assessment, of commercial prospects of the proposed permit during the permitting review, despite the plain language of the statute directing it to give consideration to and guided by that criterion, the judge wrote. While relatively unusual for Florida, companies have long drilled for oil around Santa Rosa County, community of Jay, and parts of Southwest Florida.